With a World Elite MasterCard, it's easier for you to be spontaneous with the new built-in benefits for Lyft, Fandango, Postmates, and more. These automatic benefits allow you to save more. Whether you're looking for a ride to a show, to surprise a loved one with dinner, or you just want to catch a movie on a whim, World Elite MasterCard has got you covered. Learn more about these exciting benefits at MasterCard.com/WorldElite. Terms and restrictions apply.
Now at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Play It Loud, Instruments of Rock and Roll. Tracking rock's seismic influence and the celebrated instruments that created its defining voice. Played by the Beatles, Jimi Hendrix, Joan Jett, the Rolling Stones, and other legendary musicians. Every weekend, the Met is open late Friday and Saturday. Tour the galleries, then enjoy drinks on the Cantor Roof Garden, where sculpture meets the skyline. There's always something new to experience at the Met. Preview Play It Loud at metmuseum.org.
Ladies and gentlemen, our next guests are one of my favorite new bands. Their debut album is entitled Cracked Rear View. I have a copy of it right here in the very popular CD format. Here now to perform a great song. Are you boys ready?
Oh, yeah.
Is everyone ready? Is Hootie ready? Ladies and gentlemen, Hootie and the Blowfish.
With a little love and some tenderness, we'll walk upon the water, we'll rise above the mess. With a little peace and some harmony.
Welcome to the New York Times podcast, your sweet little coochie pop of music, news, and criticism. It's your boy, John Caramonica. Big Hootie energy on the show this week. I know y'all have been waiting. Hopefully you guys read the piece I wrote a couple weeks ago, rescuing Hootie and the Blowfish from critical dismissal and anger, frustration. I was tired of it. I've been wanting to do that piece, honestly, real talk, I've been wanting to do that piece for more than a year. And I was prepared to do it. I wasn't going to interview the band or talk to the band at all. I was going to go to one of their charity shows in South Carolina last summer, just to get a vibe, and then write a piece basically being like, everyone's wrong, Hootie's been great all along, I went to go double check for myself, and in fact, that's the case. And then, of course, it turned into this very big adventure. I hope you guys have had a chance to check it out. First of all, thanks to Karen for giving me the space. Thanks to Mitha in A&L for putting it on the cover. And shouts to Jolie and Marissa in photo for making sure that the images that needed to be there were there. Big deal for me. Big podcast coming. We're actually going to do two parts because we have a lot of Hootie material to cover. So this week, part one, right off rip, what I want to do is get into undervalued Hootie and the Blowfish songs. It's very easy to be like, yes, hold my hand. Yes, I only want to be with you. Yes, let her cry. Sure, no problem. Right at the top, we open this episode with the Hold My Hand performance from Letterman in 1994. That really was the breakthrough moment and where things really started happening for the band. This is an exceptional Hootie TV performance, first TV performance, exceptional performance. But we're going to get deep. We're going to get weird. We're going to get in some later albums, some left field stuff, as left field as Hootie goes. And I'm going to talk you through a few selections from their deeper catalog that you might not be up on. Then later, we're going to talk to Tim Sommer. Tim is the A&R guy who signed Hootie to Atlantic. And Tim has written some about his experience signing and breaking Hootie and what the climate was like in the early 90s for a band like that. So we're going to get in the details. We'll get in the weeds with Tim on that subject. But first, we're going to start with Crack Rear View, which as you know, is End-to-End Bangers. It's not a soft spot on this record. Obviously, you know the hits, but those are all very front-loaded. But let's play the album closer. And I'm not even going to say what it is. I'm just going to let Darius sing.
Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. Sometimes I'm real like a motherless child. A long, long way from my home.
So clearly that is Darius Rucker singing Motherless Child. It's about a minute long. It's at the end of the album. Look, if you are a Hootie skeptic in any way, and I or anyone else is attempting to convert you, obviously you start with Darius's voice. This song really, really hits hard, really hits you in the neck right at the end of the album. And especially after, you know, 10 or 12 other songs that are embracing and uplifting, or at least rich with quasi-spiritual harmony, to hear Darius going into this deep, bellowy place for Motherless Child is incredibly powerful. A thing that you might not know about Hootie, even though it came up a little bit in my feature, and later in the episode we're going to talk to Tim Sommer, who is the A&R guy who signed Hootie, and we talk about it, but Hootie was a band with a political conscience from jump. And in the mid-90s, when there were issues around the Confederate flag being, I believe, raised at the South Carolina State House, Hootie, when they were at or near the peak of their fame, protested against it, spoke out against it. These are issues that obviously are still resonating today. They were on it in the mid-90s. And so on each of their albums, there's one or more songs that address racism on personal terms, the way that it affects interpersonal relationships, as well as political terms. So before we leave Cracked Rearview, and we're going to kind of run through all the Hootie albums now, let's listen to Drowning, which has sharp lyrics, and I think tellingly is one of the more up-tempo and rock-oriented songs on this album, as if trying to imbue it with energy to make sure that the message would not be lost.
Trouble with the world is way too busy to think about it all. Like, why is there rebel flag hanging from the state house walls? Tired of hearing this shit about here it is not here. Time to make the world a better place. Why must we hate one another? Well, no matter what, we gotta live together. Just cause you don't look like me, tell me, what do you say when we pass on the street? What do
Okay, so that's Cracked Rearview. Now we're going to get to albums that you probably have not heard. And to be fair, one or two of these I had not heard before a few months ago, if I'm being totally honest. But let's get into Fairweather Johnson. So Fairweather Johnson, this is a two-part Hootie cast, as I said before. And on episode two, we are going to talk to Danielle Smith and Jim DeRogatis, who are writers who wrote about Fairweather Johnson and Hootie in 96. But I would not say it's a top three Hootie record, but there is one especially beautiful song on it, and it's called Tootie. There's an incredible little violin part right at the top. It's a very melancholy breakup song. Rucker is in his full bravura mode, and it's a little bit of an outlier on this album. This album, there is something a little bit more concise and I would say less... It's less successful, to be sure. Best Hootie songs have a real lived-in quality, which is to say that they're like, you know, as Mr. Mort might enjoy, you know, they're molded. It's like a Birkenstock. It molds to your shape. This album is a little bit less like that, but Tootie is an excellent, excellent song. So let's get into Tootie.
Put a rose in my hand, put a dollar in my pocket, but you don't understand how the days grow longer. The sky is black as night. I see the morning, but you won't see the light. I've thought about you for a long, long time. Wrote about you, but the words weren't seeming to rhyme. And now you're lying near me, but my heart still beats for you. I had a dream about you.
Okay, let me lift your spirits real quick coming out of that. We're going to jump to 1998. Now, clearly, in the pop ecosystem by 1998, Hootie is, I want to say, functionally a non-entity. They're still on Atlantic, still putting out records every 2 years. And if you listen to these albums, they are not radically different from the album that was such a big success. But in terms of what's happening elsewhere, we're talking hip-hop's breakthrough into the mainstream. We're talking rap rock. In essence, Hootie might as well be an underground band at this point, which is frustrating because Musical Chairs, which is the third Hootie record, the third major label Hootie record, to me might be as good as Cracked Rear View. It's really good. The songs are incredibly sharp. You can tell that whatever kind of anxiety was hanging over the second record is not here anymore. And there are a bunch of great songs on this record. I want to draw your attention quickly. We don't have to play it, but there's a song called Michelle Post, which I'm pretty sure is about Darius potentially falling for a white woman who turns out has conservative politics and he literally says, your politics make me sick. It's sharp. Coming in the middle of an otherwise like cheerful and like let's hug everybody album, it's quite a jolt. So I'm just going to draw your attention to that. But what we're really going to play today is a song called Only Lonely. And Only Lonely, I mean, this is a hell of a bar soul song. Like, this is just... It's about Darius singing about what a trash guy he is and just how many mistakes he's made. And man, it's dark vibes. So let's get into Only Lonely.
Hello again. Your words, they make me smile. As I drift away in my little room upstairs. Oh, I spend my nights imagining your face, your touch. Then I realize how I don't even know your name. If we could share our time, would I disappoint your fantasies? But I believe that I could be the one you need, cause I'm only lonely on the inside. Didn't mean to take away.
One of the ways that you know that Hootie was not a priority and not playing at the peak pop level at this moment in time is that the next album after Musical Chairs, which, again, I want to emphasize, is very, very good, was a covers record. Now, Hootie started out as essentially a bar band, playing college parties, 10 songs, and playing it for beer. So, obviously, they are a band that's very flexible and really capable of adapting to a lot of styles. The covers record they put out in 2000 is called Scattered, Smothered, and Covered. Shout out all my Waffle House heads. You know what it is. And there's a lot of interesting stuff on this record. There's some obvious things like a Led Zeppelin cover and an REM cover. But what's most striking are the number of Southern kind of college rock bands that are on here. And also roots music, quasi bluegrass, things of that nature. That's really the ecosystem that they envision themselves coming out of. So it's not surprising to see a lot of that here. You know, they're not covering centrist songs. They're not covering obvious records. They're covering essentially local records, indie records, and giving them a little bit more heft and sheen. My favorite one, though, is not of an indie song. It's of a Roy Orbison song. So let's listen to Darius really giving the work to Dream Baby by Roy Orbison.
Sweet dreams, baby.
All right, we're going to give you one more song before we get into Tim Summers' conversation today. So I was lucky enough to go to the Hootie tour opener, and they played this song. And I got to be honest, I was not up on it previously, and I was a little bit caught off guard by it, because it's like a little bawdy. It's a little randy. And I don't necessarily think of Hootie exclusively in those terms, although maybe if I had been prowling the fraternities of South Carolina in 1991, I maybe would. But there is a definite part of Hootie, and this is something that will come up with DeRogatis in part two of this podcast. There is something just very bro-y about them, and you kind of can't get around some of that. And the last song that we're going to get into is off of the Hootie self-titled album. Now, this comes out in 2003. There's another record called Looking for Lucky in 2005 that we'll skip, even though there's some good stuff on there. So there's this album in 2003. I think by this point, you know, Hootie could have been made up of, like, me and you. Brad's helping out with engineering today. You know, it could have been any of us in Hootie at that point. But there is a song on this album, and like I said, it's just extremely raw Southern blues, a little bit of Southern rock. The band is incredibly loose. Rucker is clearly on one. And like I said, it's a little eyebrow raising. So for the last Hootie deep cut gem, here is Go and Tell Him, parentheses, soup song.
Stirring the soup and you stir.
They're your deep cuts. Those are the rarities. Those are the things you should be digging in the archives for. I will say, if you look around the internet, there are many places where there are Hootie bootlegs from the mid-90s floating around. I saw on Discogs, there's like some CDR copy of a BBC performance they did. There's a lot of live bootlegs. I was very surprised to find out from the guys that when they used to come to New York in the early 90s, they used to play Wetlands, RIP Wetlands. So certainly on the trader circuit, there were people who were taping them and trading those recordings. And if you dig hard enough on the internet, there are some files floating around. And also, there's a couple of old fan sites, like kind of like Angel Fire era fan sites. So if you want to carry this passion forward into your own life, there's a lot of places you can go. Now we're going to pivot and bring in Tim Sumner.
Now at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, Play It Loud, Instruments of Rock and Roll. Tracking rock's seismic influence and the celebrated instruments that created its defining voice. Played by the Beatles, Jimi Hendrix, Joan Jett, the Rolling Stones, and other legendary musicians. Every weekend, the Met is open late Friday and Saturday. Tour the galleries, then enjoy drinks on the Cantor Roof Garden, where sculpture meets the skyline. There's always something new to experience at the Met. Preview Play It Loud at metmuseum.org.
With the World Elite MasterCard, it's easier for you to be spontaneous with the new built-in benefits for Lyft, Fandango, Postmates, and more. These automatic benefits allow you to save more. Whether you're looking for a ride to a show, to surprise a loved one with dinner, or you just want to catch a movie on a whim, World Elite MasterCard has got you covered. Learn more about these exciting benefits at MasterCard.com/WorldElite. Terms and restrictions apply.
Okay, hopefully all that rare Hootie heat has gotten you excited to hear more about Hootie and the Blowfish. If you weren't already sold, I hope you are sold now. Tim Sumner is calling in. Tim is on the phone. Tim's the A&R guy who signed Hootie to Atlantic. What's up, Tim? How are you doing?
I'm doing very, very well, John. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
I'm so happy you're here. You are responsible for Hootie being on Atlantic. Let me tell people a little bit about what you were doing before that.
Sure.
You used to play music. You played with Glenn Branca. You played in Hugo Largo. You were a writer. Did I read that you wrote for Trouser Press when you were like 16? Is that real?
Yeah, that was my first, probably actually 15 and a half.
Woo.
That was my very first job. I left high school early, and I announced to my parents I was going to get a job at a rock magazine in New York City. And you did. I asked Trouser Press if they needed an office boy, and I took the train in from Great Neck and started working at Trouser Press, and they allowed me to start writing there almost right away, which was quite wonderful.
At 15, I was reviewing the PM Dawn debut album for the high school newspaper. Just throwing that out there.
See, you got to...
We all start somewhere. And then you A&R'd at Atlantic. Now, I know a little bit about the Hootie signing story from Darius and the guys. I've also read you wrote a very long piece in The Observer a few years ago where you really mapped out a lot of the shenanigans that were going on around that. And you also wrote the liner notes for the 25th anniversary box that Rhino just dropped maybe like 2-3 weeks ago. But let's take, for our listeners who maybe are not privy to all this depth of information, tell me a little bit about the culture of Atlantic at that time, and when you stumbled upon Hootie, how'd you stumble on them, and then how did you kind of convince or maybe fail to convince people that they were the right fit?
Well, it's an interesting story on a number of different levels. Circa 1992, which is when I had joined Atlantic, Atlantic had lagged behind in the grunge sweepstakes. As you certainly know, grunge had caused a revolution in the music industry, and there are a lot of different reasons for that. But basically, it was almost a movement that the record companies did not originally have control over, for the simple reason that American major record labels had buried punk rock. They had assumed that punk rock, which had not really sold for them in the late 1970s, had been a non-starter, had been watered down into sort of MTV-friendly new wave. And then by the late 1980s, when aggressive, simplistic, and I say simplistic in a very favorable way.
That's true. In this, you know, on Popcast, simple is favorable.
Let's call it simplistic Ramones and Black Flag-based rock and roll began to make a significant mark on the independent market and on the consumer market in the late 1980s. The major labels were not prepared, but a few of them were smart enough to get ahead of the game. And by 1991, 1992, all of the major labels were significantly invested in grunge, with the exception of Atlantic Records. Atlantic Records, and I wish this was an exaggeration, but it's not, circa 1991, 1992, Atlantic was still chasing Sunset Strip hair metal when all the other labels were chasing grunge in Seattle. In 1991, maybe it was late 1991, I don't know the exact date, Atlantic brought in Danny Goldberg to sort of, I want to say, be number two at the label and to shore up their West Coast office. Atlantic's West Coast presence had always been minimal. They brought in Danny Goldberg to run a West Coast office. And since Danny, by that point, even though he had a long, long history in rock and roll involving Led Zeppelin, Bonnie Raitt, God knows what else, Danny, by 1991-92, had got a great reputation because of the work he had done with Nirvana and Sonic Youth. Danny had known me for a long time. He had known me as a friend. He had known me as a musician. He had known me as an MTV personality. And what Danny knew about me circa 1992 was that I had a lot of alternative credibility. I had been very involved in the early days of the Beastie Boys. I had been great friends with Sonic Youth. I had had a very well-known punk rock radio show in New York. I think Danny thought, okay, if I want someone to help me on the A&R end to bring in credible, interesting, alternative rock bands, I'll bring in Tim Sommer. And he did. And bizarrely, the first band I signed to Atlantic was Hootie and the Blowfish.
A deeply credible band. I just want to say it so the cheap seats can hear it.
I want to make it very, very clear. I will never claim to having discovered Hootie and the Blowfish. How could you discover a band who, by the time I first saw them, had been playing for 8 years, were packing clubs, absolutely packing clubs, already had an independent CD that was probably one of the 10 best-selling CDs at a lot of stores in the Carolinas and in the Mid-South.
Called Coochie Pop.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I've always said that, you know, the question isn't why was this guy smart enough to sign Hootie and the Blowfish? The question is why was everyone else so dumb that they didn't?
And just to contextualize for people, because things are so different these days in terms of how artists are discovered, you're talking about local store sales charts and regional heat seekers. And so as an A&R guy, obviously, one of the ways that you keep tabs on the country is saying, well, is something germinating in the Carolinas? Is something bubbling around in Texas? And there were charts and stores like local retail outlets would call in and say, hey, these are the top 10 CDs or LPs that sell. And so part of your job at that time was probably to look, in essence, for anomalies, right? To say like, huh, that's weird. I've never heard of that, but it's doing really well.
That is precisely right. And I think something you just said before about how different the environment was, it takes very little, extremely little intention to take your finger, enter in one or two letters on a computer or on your phone, and click on a band. You know, you're not going to know a lot about how the world is moving and how culture is moving by what I call the quick click or thumb click economy. That's not going to tell you a lot. But in the 1980s, 1990s, if someone made the effort to get into their car, drive to a store, find a parking space, reach into their pocket, take out long green cash, or take out their credit card and say, hey, of the 4,000 CDs in this store, I want to buy that one. That is a sign of intention. And if somebody exerts that attention over and over and over again, you can say, there's a movement going on. So what was interesting was circa 1993, there were a lot of bands in the Mid-South that had really gigantic local followings, bands playing original music.
While we're on the topic of Coochie Pop, let's listen to a Coochie Pop song that did not make any of the subsequent records, but it's still very good. It's called If You're Going My Way.
Get all your problems and troubles you leave behind if you're going my way.
We should contextualize a little bit, because obviously if you think of the college rock of the late, mid to late 80s, but late 80s especially, the South especially, your REM and REM adjacent projects, a lot of really interesting music is coming from that region, and there is an established touring circuit in that region for bands like that. So in a sense, what Hootie was doing was taking, you know, not that they didn't break down the barriers between in certain venues or whatnot, but there is an established route in that part of the country for bands of that nature. Hootie, I think, was one of the better bands of that style, but that scene and that circuit was very much in play by a lot of people.
That's exactly right, and it's a very important circuit. I've always said that if you want to know the story of American alternative music, you look at Winston-Salem in 1975, not CBGB's in 1975.
Wow, interesting, yeah.
The roots of American independent music is largely in the Carolinas, because it's the Carolinas that yelped Athens, Georgia, that always had the best independent record stores. But long story short, in New York City or Los Angeles or whatnot, you didn't have people going out three or four nights a week just to dance to live music, many of these bands played original music. Circa 1993, and I'm picking out that year specifically, 1992, 1991, there were a couple of bands that were playing in front of 800 to 2,000 people. 2,000 might be a little on the high side. So let's say 600 to 1,500 people at least one night a week playing largely original music. If you ask me to name four that were doing equal business, I would say Hootie and the Blowfish, the Dave Matthews Band, Johnny Quest, who were a band from the Carolinas, and Cowboy Mouth, who were a band from Louisiana. And I wasn't a genius for signing Hootie and the Blowfish. I was a genius for knowing to sign Hootie and the Blowfish and not sign Johnny Quest.
Right.
Johnny Quest were a band from the Carolinas who were doing the same business as Hootie. They were a Red Hot Chili Peppers, Beastie Boys type band. Again, doing the same business, playing much of the same show, but they didn't have the songs. They had the live performance. They had the following. If you were just to look plainly at the numbers, you'd probably see the same numbers. But as you've seen in the stuff that I wrote, who, and I really mean this, who could walk into a club, see a band on stage playing Let Her Cry, and say, okay, I pretty much have to sign that band. To me, the sound of Hootie and the Blowfish, although they had a sort of Mellencamp, Seeger, Springsteen thing that REM did not necessarily have, in so many ways, the sound of the band, the formation of the band, the relationship between the band members, the way they composed, the way they approached songwriting, the way they approached their stagecraft, so very, very much reminded me of REM. And if you grew up in a certain time, REM are very near and dear to your hearts. And circa 1992, 93, when I was an A&R person, there were very, very few bands that had that REM vibe.
Let's listen actually to an early REM song. Let's listen to Talk About the Passion, which is off Murmur.
Into your prime, into your
I agree with you. I hear a lot of REM. But I think what happened with REM as they moved into or towards the mainstream, or rather as the mainstream became more aware of what REM was posited as, I don't want to say avant-garde because it really wasn't, but slightly more arty than a Hootie or like that. But to me, REM in its roots is a very accessible, dare I say, centrist band. And so what I hear in Hootie is that version of REM. I mean, I'd hear the eccentricities of the early to mid-90s, but I do hear that kind of earthy centrism of the early stuff.
When I listened to the Hootie EP, I heard a kind of jangly, sensitive but centrist college rock that reminded me a great deal of the music that I had heard when I listened to REM, when I listened to the DBs, even to a degree when I listened to the Feelies. I later was to find out that really Hootie's primary influences on that regard, they studied REM like a Shakespearean scholar studies Shakespeare text.
Okay, so Hootie grounded in Southern college rock history. When you go down to South Carolina, you say, I see it, I get the vision. You bring it back to Atlantic, and Atlantic says what?
Well, they basically gave me free rein to sign the band. There was no issue with that.
But they didn't give you, like, millions of dollars as an advance?
That's correct. They gave me an extremely lowball figure. But that wasn't because of the quality of what Hootie and the Blowfish were doing. That was because of the demand. The kind of money that a band is going to get, I can't speak about present terms, I can only speak about my own experience in the 1990s and a little beyond. What a band gets from a record company in terms of a record deal is 100% based on demand, not on quality. Meaning, you could be the worst band in the world that isn't going to sell any records, but if 10 different labels are after you, you can write your own ticket with a contract. On the other hand, you can be in a Hootie and the Blowfish, and not one other label wants you, and you'll get an extremely lowball contract.
I don't know if this made it into the final layout of the piece, but the Hootie guys sent over to us copies of all the rejection letters that they had received, which is really funny. They're all very, like, form letter rejections, but they're just, like, from everyone, which, you know, obviously in hindsight is super LOL. In your Observer piece, you mention kind of a gambit when the record came out that you put into motion to get the band noticed, right?
That's correct.
So I'd love it if you could talk through the gambit.
Well, I mean, first I'll preface it by saying that, you know, Atlantic had no resistance in signing the band, provided it cost very little, and it did. And we made a terrific album with Don Gaiman, who was an incredibly easy selection as a producer because he had worked with R.E.M. and John Mellencamp, and it didn't take an idiot to see that Hootie and the Blowfish should be making a record that was exactly between R.E.M. and John Mellencamp. As we positioned to put the record out, we, especially at Atlantic, I knew we weren't going to get radio on board right away. They weren't going to pay attention. I knew we weren't going to get the video people on board because there wasn't even a video made at the time of the release. The question was, how were we going to get Atlantic to pay attention to this record? And myself and Kim Kyman, who was the product manager of the band and really in many ways the godmother of the project, came up with a very simple solution. And I remember this is the exact conversation we had with the salespeople. We said to the salespeople, and this is the opposite of what most A&R people would say or most record company people would say at the time. We said to the salespeople, on the day of the album's release, I don't care if there's not one single copy of this record in New York or Los Angeles. And that's contrary to normal thinking, of course.
Right,
every
of course.
A&R person wants to be able to walk down to Tower Records and go, hey, there's my record that just came out. We literally said, I do not care if there's not one single copy of this record in New York or Los Angeles or Boston or Detroit, but in the Carolinas, stock this thing like it's Pearl Jam. And they're like, well, what are you talking about? And I was saying, just trust us on that. Call the stores and say, we have a new Hootie and the Blowfish record coming out, and they're going to tell you they want it like it's Pearl Jam.
Exactly. Right. So super serve those locations, those regions. Because ultimately, look, Coochie Pop, So before you even signed them, Coochie Pop was already on Billboard Regional Heat Seeker. So it's not far-fetched to think that you could achieve the same thing with a bigger, more polished record.
That's exactly right. And the theory was, and then we sat back and hoped that would work. And it worked beyond our wildest dreams.
Obviously, the breakthrough moment for Hootie is the Letterman performance. That's the kind of the turning point in terms of getting eyeballs on them. You had to make videos. You had a band who is sort of like defiantly regular, anti-style. What were some of the battles or obstacles of getting a sort of authentic version of Hootie, but also giving them the big label treatment, you know, which is very different than what they were used to?
You know, I don't remember there being very many obstacles at all at that point. I will say, and I don't think I've ever actually told anyone this, I objected to the album cover. And for better or worse, no one listened to my objections.
Were you objecting to the fact that you couldn't really see them?
I said, it feels to me that we're trying to hide that there's an African-American in the band. Because remember, the album, because as I said before, there was no video at the time of release. Hootie were not considered a priority enough to make a video. So we only had the images from the album cover, and in those days, album covers mattered at least a little. And I said, it's weird to me that it feels like we're trying to hide the fact that there's an African-American in the band, especially since, though it's difficult to imagine at this point, very early going, I remember people saying that they thought Darius sounded like Eddie Vedder.
Yes. The fact that they weren't visible on the album cover maybe was their idea, or they were on board with the idea, even if it wasn't theirs.
I think they signed off on everything.
Yeah. Because I think they the way they framed it to me is, you know, we, for the last 8 years, we've been a famous band doing things on our own terms, and we're not comfortable with, like, big fame. Let's basically be as kind of removed and kind of anti-fame as possible, even though we're now signed to a big label. And that was part of, I don't know if it's a strategy necessarily, but it was part of that overall perspective. That's how it was framed to me.
I also think that this is another thing they had learned from REM. As they may have told you, they very much structured their business after REM.
Oh, no, we didn't really talk that much about that, but that makes a lot of sense.
Meaning all publishing got split four ways, regardless of who wrote the songs. All songwriting credits and all publishing would be split four ways. That was an REM thing. The manager split wasn't a percentage split, but a five-way split, meaning that the manager got paid equal to everything the band made. That also was based on the REM Jefferson Holt model. So likewise, I think probably REM also did not prominently feature images of themselves on their album sleeves. So I'm sure they took from that as well. I also know that at all points they were greatly influenced by Toad the Wet Sprocket.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And every step of the way, Hootie treated success with enormous humility, and they treated it like, well, we're just doing our job. And I think one of the first and one of the best examples of this, while their first big tour was, I guess, the autumn of 1994, out in theaters and ballrooms, opening for Toad the Wet Sprocket. It was during that tour that the album began to blow up and become a big hit record. At that point, probably about halfway through the tour, Toad's people, I think they both had the same booking agent, Toad's people, Toad's label, and Atlantic all went to the band, all went to Hootie and said, we need to flip headliners. Hootie should be closing the show. Toad should be opening for you guys. Things have changed. And Hootie said, absolutely not. That doesn't happen.
Yeah.
We open for Toad the Wet Sprocket.
I did speak to the guys about that, and they did tell me that story partially. And they also said, the thing that they said, which I thought was really so spot on, was when that tour started, they were just very excited to open for Toad the Wet Sprocket. Like, no matter how successful they had become, they felt so strongly about Toad as a band, right, that they were just very, very excited at that opportunity. And that even though their circumstances had shifted over the course of those months, that the fundamental reason that they went on that tour, they chose to sort of honor and stick with, which is, yeah. And I thought that was very generous and kind. And, you know, that's just spoke a lot about them. I want to play a song by Toad the Wet Sprocket, which is not a sentence I ever thought I would say on Popcast. But I'm really happy. I'm really happy that I can, because this song is a banger. 1992. It's off the album called Fear. The song is All I Want. Get a Kleenex.
Nothing so loud, searing when we lie. Truth is not kind, and you said neither am I. In the air outside, so soft, saying everything, everything. All I want is to feel this way, to be this close, feel the same. All I want is to feel this way, the evening speaks, feel it say.
Things start to take off. Mid-94, late-94.
I remember, I specifically remember it went gold in January of 1995. And I remember that being early January 1995, we got the information that the album had gone gold. And I just think it was something that none of us had ever expected. And a lot of that has to do with the REM model again. This is a band that had grown up in the college rock era. And the college rock era, what you did was you sold X amount of records, just enough to keep your label from dropping you. You made fans on the road. Then you came back and sold a few more records.
Right.
And then by album 4 or 5, you finally had your gold record.
Yeah, it was very incremental, chipping away at, you know, bands of that nature didn't really explode. Except, I mean, you know, you could say the REM, like when they finally found their identity as a video band and a visual band, like they had a moment. But generally, bands of that scene, it was like almost workmanlike. It was just like, this one's going to be 2 inches further out than the last one, and then the next one's going to be another 3 inches further.
And then, as I, you know, and again, it's a different subject, I think that workmanlike attitude ultimately is one of the things that brought about that hurt the band going forward, but that's a whole other story. I know I can speak for myself and say we never took it for granted. I never took it for granted. I knew we were going through something very rare, and I knew that this was probably the only time in my life that I was ever going to experience that kind of sensation. And I think the band thought very much the same thing. They were very humble. They were very grateful. I think they really treasured this unique moment in culture in 1995 and 1996 as Hootie just kept on selling more and more and more records. Now, towards the end of 1995, the band began saying to me, we're playing songs out there that we've been playing for 10 years. We need to record a new record.
A bunch of the Cracked Review stuff was on Coochie Pop. It was re-recorded, remastered. Just people don't, I don't know if everybody knows that, but some of those songs, including some of the bigger ones, were previously released, or at minimum, were songs that they were playing on the road,
yeah,
even if they hadn't actually made it to that record.
So towards the end of 1995, despite the fact that the record was snowballing, the record was picking up steam a year and a half after it had been released. The record was picking up steam. It was beginning to sell more and more. The band began saying, we need to get into the studio and make a new record, because they thought, okay, we're a band, and what a band does is they tour and they make records. We need to make a new record. But it was a wonderful and strange ride while they were at their peak. I think they were very, very good to their old friends. The bands that they either looked up to, like Nancy Griffith or John Hiatt,
yeah, mm-hmm,
or the bands that had once upon a time done them favors, like Cowboy Mouth, they returned all those favors. They took those acts on the road with them. They overpaid them. I remember at one point, I can't remember the, I won't say the name of the artist. It was an artist who they were paying like, you know, 15 grand a night to. And this was an artist that really should have been being paid 2 grand a night. And I was like, why are you paying so-and-so so much money? And they said, because we can. And they were that kind of band. They were that kind of band. They were the kind of band who, honestly, and I say this with zero hyperbole. They were the nicest band I'd ever met. And whether we're talking about a band that I saw at TT the Bears in Cambridge in front of 40 people, or a band I saw play in front of 250,000 people in some field somewhere, this was the nicest band I'd ever met. So to see them having that kind of success and not universally not letting it go to their heads, they would still, we go out there, we have a job to do. Afterwards, we go out and see some bands. If we see who's playing in town, we go out to see some bands. We never let them let us into the club for free. We always insist that we pay.
Yeah.
You know, that sort of thing.
Given that you knew the music was good, given that you knew that they were good, like decent human beings, obviously part of the reason I wrote the piece that I wrote, and to some degree that you wrote the Observer piece that you wrote, is there is this kind of, or has been this narrative of disrespect or ignoring Hootie and not kind of giving them their due, not taking them as seriously as I have always felt that they deserve to be taken, and I'm sure you do as well. Did you guys, because they felt it, I think, maybe not in the moment of 95, 96, but certainly like in the later 90s, I think they were aware of that narrative. Were you aware of that as the person who had signed them and was watching how they were being received in the world? Did you sense that that was happening? And if so, what do you think was behind that?
What was behind it was they had erupted on the national consciousness so quickly that people didn't realize that they had the same grungy background as any other act that had risen through the alternative circuit. In fact, more so.
Exactly.
That they had spent 6-8 years toiling away in little clubs, putting out cassettes, putting up flyers. They had done all of the same work as any reputable indie act, but people didn't know that because they hadn't done it in Boston. They hadn't done it in Seattle. They hadn't done it in New York City.
And there's a smugness with that scene. Like, we don't really think about it that much anymore, but the people who are sort of the self-professed connoisseurs of that kind of sound, there is a little bit of a smugness, right? Of like, oh, I knew, you know, the late 80s and the 90s were very much like this. It's like, I know about this obscure thing, and therefore, and if it's not obscure, therefore it must not have value. You know, the 2010s are very different. There are plenty of people who take centrist pop music very seriously. There's a lot of weird music that is centrist pop music, but the lines, the battle lines were very different back then. And I think you're right that the sort of tastemaker cities, right? New York, Los Angeles, the Midwest. That's not where Hootie was popular. They were popular in the South. They were popular in college towns. They were popular with non-tastemaker people. And so when they finally blew up, it was basically like what we would say in these days, like industry plant. It'd just be like, oh, it's like the watered down version of all this other stuff. And now it's like the most popular thing in America. That was the perception.
There's very little difference. Extremely little difference between what Hootie and the Blowfish do and what, say, Joe Henry does, or the Jayhawks do, or Victoria Williams does, or fill in the blank.
And that's how they conceived of themselves. Like, that, what's so funny is when I was talking to them about that era, like, they conceived of themselves as like REM meets Radney Foster or something, you know, which no person in New York listening to them in 1994 would have been like, that's what this band is.
Yeah.
But that's how they understood themselves.
You know, by the time people, tastemakers, quote-unquote, including people who would have liked music they did, heard of them, they were already a gold record.
Right, and people hate being late. They hate being wrong.
No, and it's like, I remember thinking at the time, the other thing that they had against them was, you know, grunge was followed in many ways by this sort of super cartoon nihilism of stuff like Marilyn Manson and Nine Inch Nails, which posited itself as the anti-Hootie. But on the other hand, to me, that stuff is phony. You know, you go back 10 years from 1995, and Trent Reznor is playing keyboards in a new wave band, a new wave cover band. Whereas you go back 10 years from 1995, Hootie and the Blowfish are still being Hootie and the Blowfish.
And they never changed.
That's exactly
like,
right.
That's the thing about Hootie, is they literally never changed. Their context changed. Their spotlight changed. But the band itself basically remained as was.
The other aspect of Hootie's legacy that I think is very, very important is, to me, they are the apogee of the 1980s, 1990s college rock movement.
Absolutely. 100%.
And I think they do not get credit for that. I think there's a college rock movement that began in the Carolinas in the mid-1970s, specifically Winston-Salem, with people like Mitch Easter and Don Dixon and Chris Stamey and Peter Holzapfel, and that spread out to Atlanta, to Jefferson Holt running his record store in North Carolina, and then the people in Athens, and it was a very important movement, and I think Hootie were the apogee of that. They're almost the last, to me, they're almost the period on the great college rock sentence that began in Winston-Salem.
Right. And also, I mean, you mentioned Peter Holzapfel. I mean, Holzapfel tours with the band. You know, it's like if you need any clearer neon blinking light to draw that line through, you know, through all those bands. I mean, Holzapfel's there today.
That's a connection I'm extremely proud of, as Peter will tell you, or I think the band members know this. After we finished recording the record, but before it was released, I sent Peter a cassette. And I said to Peter, I don't know if these guys ever are able to afford a fifth member on the road. You have to be the guy. And lo and behold, when they were able to afford a fifth member, they bought him Peter, and they were just never, I think they never, to this day, they're excited that Peter's on stage with them.
Tim, I need all this and more in your book, okay? Thank you so much for your time today and for signing Hootie and the Blowfish. Very important in my life, and I'm grateful for it to this day.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, Tim. Appreciate it. We're going to go out with a Hootie classic. It's Only Want to Be With You. Grab a loved one. Give them a hug. Tell them you care about them. That is our show, Big Hootie. We're coming back in a few days with part two, more Hootie vibes. Thank you to Tim Sommer for being here this week. You can listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Email us. One of the real rewarding parts of this Hootie experience over the last few weeks is just people real coming out of the woodworks to share their Hootie love. I see people on Facebook talking about it. I see grown men reassessing their relationship with Hootie and the Blowfish, which was formed in the cauldron of the judgmental 90s. And now, as people have gotten older and softened a little bit, but also matured, they can embrace and accept that Hootie and the Blowfish is an excellent band. So to those people, I salute you. Email me if you have a conversion experience that you want to share at podcast@nytimes.com. Subscribe to the podcast anywhere you get your audio content. Google Play, Stitcher, iTunes, the Apple Podcast app. I don't know, wherever you get your audio, we're there. Our producer is Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media, with an assist from Brad Fisher this week. We will be back next week.